Hey everybody, welcome to Marooncast, where we talk about design, lifestyle, and entrepreneurship. I am Hector Real, along with my co-host, Ben Wetzel.
Hey, that's me.
We are professional designers with over 20 years of experience, where we aim to help you be more successful in your creative endeavors.
You're going to get good.
Very nice, Ben. Well done. In this episode, we're going to be talking about how to become a more versatile designer. Basically, a lot of clients, if you're a freelancer, are going to be asking you to do different projects that you may or may not be an expert on. So we're going to be talking about how to become more of an expert on more things. But first, hey, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Well, I've got a question for you.
Okay, let's hear it.
Do you remember the Toyota Supra of old?
Oh, yeah.
Now, my next question is, have you seen the Toyota Supra of new?
Yes, I have.
What are your thoughts?
It's got a really big butt.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of junk in the trunk, if you will.
I mean, almost literally speaking.
Yeah. I mean, luckily it's like, what, all carbon fiber, so it's not really that heavy, but it just kind of...
I don't know if it's all carbon fiber. I'm sure it's got carbon fiber in it. I doubt that it's all carbon fiber.
Oh, okay. Well, then it probably actually does have a lot of junk in its trunk.
Oh, I see what you did there. You set me up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I wanted to talk about the design aspect of the Toyota Supra. The Toyota Supra of the early 2000s and 90s, late 90s, I should say, was a juggernaut in the car scene. I was a teenager at the time, and I was in the racing scene at the time. And so this was one of the dream cars that we would hope that we could afford as we get older. I worked at a race shop, believe it or not. I worked at a race shop as a mechanic, and I would lower cars and install turbos basically all day long. So I knew the inner workings of the car and the import scene and how the racing scene kind of grew up from there. Now, there are a lot of different cars during that generation, but the reason why we're talking about the Toyota Supra now is because of the new generation that came out. I mean, it took more than a decade to come into fruition.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, so everybody was waiting. Now, when you have a car that was held in such high regard as the old Supra was, the Mark IV, you're going to have a very specific following, similar to what you might have with the original Star Wars, when the new Star Wars came out, or a certain episode that people didn't like came out.
Sure.
You're going to get some backlash. Now, Toyota had put out a quote-unquote Supra recently, and I had a chance to look at it during the New York Auto Show. We were at the New York Auto Show last month, or rather 2 months ago. And I'm going to reserve my thoughts on that because I wanted to address a couple of other things regarding this. And the reason why we're talking about it is because there's just kind of been this uproar about people not liking the new Supra because people love the old Supra so much. And this would be a design conversation. I'm not going to get into the specifics of power output, handling, or anything like that right now. But since in this segment, it's a design show, we're going to be talking about the design. So I'm going to throw this over to you, Ben. What's your impression with the old Supra versus the new?
Well, I mostly know about the Supra because it's... I actually didn't know it was used for American street racing. I know it from Japanese drifting. It's one of the apex predators in that drifting scene, along with several other amazing vehicles, some of them from Toyota. But the Supra was always one of the bigger cars in the drifting scene. I mean that like physically. It's a much larger car than some of the other drifters. And but it was still sort of always held with massive regard. But no matter what you did to it in terms of aftermarket bodying, it always had really soft elliptical curves. And I haven't had a huge chance to see the entire frame or the entire body of the new one, but it just does not hold a lot of those old shapes, which I think is probably what makes people so upset.
You're exactly right. I mean, the older Supra was really great if you sat into it. It was one of the few cars at the time that offered, well, I said I was going to get into the specifics of the mechanicals, but here it goes. It's one of those, it was at the time, it was one of the few cars offered with a 6-speed manual transmission. And
Right.
6-speed, and it was a flat six. Rather, I take that back. So it was inline six, I'm sorry. Inline six motor, which produced a lot of torque at the time. And it was physically larger because the block was physically larger as well.
It was big, yeah.
So, and here's a design term, the dash two axle. The dash two axle is a car design term, which is the distance at which the A-pillar touches down and how far that is to where the front wheel hub is. So that's called the dash two axle. And generally, what happens is that if the dash two axle is long, even if you didn't know what the car was, then you'd automatically be able to tell that it was a front engine car. Now, it's a front engine car and it's an inline six, which means that it's two cylinders longer than even V8s. So it had a really long front end and it was a powerful engine. It was a great engine and it was twin turbos, at least if you got that option, it was a twin turbo engine. And so when you got into it, it was definitely a racing powerful car. For a long time, it was regarded as kind of like the Japanese muscle car because it was so big. Curves were voluptuous and it was definitely hunkered down. It had fat tires.
Yeah, low to the ground.
And the biggest feature that it had was the giant spoiler that nobody else sported before then.
I guess that's true. I never really thought about
that. Well, because now we've got a ton of spoilers everywhere now.
Yeah, yeah.
But back then, nobody else had it.
Yeah, and that spoiler is massive.
Yeah, it was huge.
It was gigantic.
But you knew it was a Supra. You knew when it was coming. So even back then, the drifting scene had not become popular yet. I mean, maybe it was still burgeoning in Japan, but it hadn't hit the United States yet. And generally here was drag racing.
Yeah, for sure.
So the Supra was perfect for that type of racing because it had such fat tires. It was hunkered down and it was a powerful car. It wasn't an 8, but an inline 6 produces enough torque plus turbochargers. So definitely was an icon of its day. Now, fast forward that to today's Supra. I mean, there was a whole thing about it where they had a partnership with BMW, and so it used the same chassis as BMW. So they were basically limited in what shapes that they could put the Supra in. But it, long story short, as a Supra fan of old and as a professional car designer, I'm going to have to lay it down and basically, you know, agree with everybody else, is that the Supra of new missed the mark.
Kind of reminds me of like a Camaro almost.
No,
at least the back part, it had like some almost 90 degree.
Like, it's got some weird shapes to it.
Yeah.
The new Supra is overly curvaceous in its shape. And when you start designing vehicles with overly curvaceous shapes, you kind of get into a cutesy type of look and feel, which is the complete opposite of the old Supra, which was a monster. And I get the whole thing of what the designer was trying to do. I mean, you have the Formula One-esque front fascia on it. And there's a lot of grills on it. One of the biggest things that people really didn't like is that it had so many grills, something ridiculous, like 17 grills that didn't work.
Goodness.
Yeah. And so the lines just didn't match up. It was chunky. It was kind of fat, which is a far cry from the old Supra. And if you were to compare the two, you're like, it's not even the same car. So I say that to say this. is the new Supra, I believe the, you can correct me on this later, I believe the concept code is the A90. I think that the new Supra isn't technically a bad car. And bear with me on this. The new Supra is not a bad car per se. It's a bad Supra, is what I'm trying to say.
Fair.
You know, I think using this as a successor to the old Supra, which was iconic and powerful and almost put up in a pedestal by those who had it hung up on their walls as a poster, and you basically just ruined their dreams. So now I say that it's not a bad car, because if you were to see this car on the road and nobody said it was a Supra, it's fine. It's not the prettiest car in the world, but it's fine. It's not horrible. So my point is that the mistake is on the marketing side. They really shouldn't have called the A90 the Supra. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
The car itself looks fine on the road. It even looks better in person. The photos, you know, it looks horrible in photos, but it looks really great in person. It's completely different. And that's kind of a feature that it has.
I see what you're talking about, the front.
Yeah. So here's my thing. If Toyota marketing said, hey, look, this doesn't really look like the Supra, let's not call it the Supra. If Toyota marketing said, hey, let's call this the new Celica, it, I think, would have been much more successful.
Oh yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense now that I'm looking at it from multiple angles. Yeah,
it does look kind of like a Celica.
It does,
and the Celica of old and the Celica previous to that, it has the same lines, the same shapes. It has its odd features, but saying it's a Celica makes those odd features kind of more attractive. So now imagine this car, the A90. I really hope that's the correct concept car term for it, is rolling down the road, but it's a Celica. I think everybody's perceptions would change to something more positive. So I'm going to point the finger at the marketing and branding department for this. It's because they made a mistake by saying, oh yeah, it's out, it's a Supra. If they would have kept the Supra to the Mark IV, and waited until they had a time to develop what's basically a supercar version of a Supra, they would have been more successful for that. But for the A90, if they would have called that a Supra, then this would have been a, you know, much more successful campaign.
Right.
And, you know, maybe by after calling this a Celica, that might have bought them another 4 years to develop a supercar Supra that's worthy of the name.
Well, I mean, I'm looking through specs on this thing, and I mean, no matter if you're drifting or you're drag racing or street racing, you're doing that in a manual transmission. And from everything I can tell, this car doesn't come with a manual transmission.
Well, most cars don't really come with manual transmissions anymore. A lot of the automatic, clutched automatic transmissions, dual clutch ones, are faster than manual transmissions.
Sure.
Even the new Porsches have, I don't believe that they offer manual transmissions unless it's like a GT2 or GT3.
I feel like that's going to make drifting harder though.
I think that's something that needs to be modified on the car for drifting. But I think for your normal everyday car, I'm sure it's very powerful. I mean, you know, I've driven the Porsche 991 and that was plenty powerful. And I've got a 911 as well, and I have a manual transmission, and I think that's really fun, but I think that most of the future is going to be either full automatic or a clutched automatic for whatever brand name they have for it. So that is, I try to make that as quick as I can. And I could talk more about the Supra, but we should probably get on to the next segments of the show.
Sure.
Before we get into the next segments of the show, do stop by our website. That is www.maroonvaultstudio.com. And this next part of the show is where we answer some questions and maybe give some tips on how to become a better designer or how to make a bit more revenue as a designer based on our own experiences. So do visit our website or follow me on Instagram. My Instagram is @IamHectorReal. That is at the letter I, the letter A, the letter M, Hector Real. And if you have any questions, feel free to DM me. And if I can answer them in a couple of sentences, I will. If not, I will forward that as another episode of our show. And if you have any questions that you'd like for us to answer specifically for our Maroon Cast show, drop us an email and we'll put it into our next episode. All right. What are we talking about today, Ben?
Yeah, talking about how to make ourselves more versatile so that, you know, you don't want to broaden out too much because you want to be really good at the things you do. But, you know, it's always good to have a little extra tool in the tool chest sort of thing. And so if you're a great graphic designer and, you know, you're just a champion at making logos, maybe you should also be working on your layout skills so you can be like good at InDesign. So you're not just an Illustrator guy, you're a InDesign and Illustrator guy. Or, you know, everybody is using After Effects these days. Maybe you should know a little bit more about motion graphics so that you can take your logo and make like an intro for a YouTube channel, something like that.
Right, absolutely. So basically, based on our own experiences, generally, if you've worked with a client long enough, they're going to ask you to do other things that you may or may not be an expert on, or you may or may not have gone to school for. And I agree with you completely. You shouldn't really refer to yourself, I mean, obviously refer to yourself as a designer and in whatever specific industry you're in, but also have a broader term for yourself, which is creative. And part of being creative is problem solving.
Absolutely.
So, and it's not just problem solving for design, it's problem solving for a company who needs your help.
In general, yeah. Be someone that is proactive. Be someone that can help them with their issues, not just make the art.
Right. So generally, sometimes a project may start with, hey, can you design me a logo and some business cards? And you do that, and you do a phenomenal job. Wow, I can't say phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
Exactly. So if you do a phenomenal job, they're going to keep asking for your expertise.
Yeah.
And that might lead into, hey, can you help us design packaging design? Can you help us do PowerPoint presentations? And to be completely honest, part of our business hinges a lot on PowerPoint presentations.
Yeah. Layout is important.
Layout is very important. And that isn't something that we went to school for in general, but we do know graphic design and we do know that it translates. And so,
for sure.
Yeah, we sharpened our skills as over the years and we have become expert at PowerPoint. And yeah. PowerPoint is, man, that program frustrates me.
Oh, God, yeah.
PowerPoint is not specifically built for
beautiful art,
high-end graphics.
Yeah,
it can be very frustrating.
Oh, those layers.
Yeah, and you know, as a designer, you want to develop really beautiful, impactful designs, and PowerPoint sometimes won't let you do that.
No, so, what PowerPoint right. says.
But here's the thing: PowerPoint is the standard, and it's a program that's built into almost every single work computer. So you're gonna have to learn it. But you know, it's one of those things that you'll be able to kind of charge for, not kind of charge for, you'll be able to charge for once you become really good at it. So
plus it'll help you yourself with your communication with other people. I mean, I know the whole standing up and going through a PowerPoint is almost cliche at this point, but when you're trying to convey your ideas to somebody, what do? You might use your hands to help communicate without even knowing it. Well, why not just step it up? Why not have some visual aids? Yeah. And if you're going to have visual aids, make sure that they look good and are clean and easy to understand and read visually with the eye. And then bam.
Right. Because you're a designer after all.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, here's another thing. And you basically gave me a really good idea for another show, which is we should talk about how to present ideas.
Absolutely.
Because that's a really big part, because nobody can present and convey your ideas better than you.
Yeah. You also brought something up that I'd really like to go back and reiterate on. In terms of being versatile, yes, the material goods are really important, like knowing how to do multiple things and knowing more than just one to two programs. But you said problem solving.
Right.
And I think that that's a really important thing that as a professional, you need to be doing. You need to get your head in that space where you're not an artist necessarily. You're not a designer necessarily. You're a creative and or a problem solver.
Right.
What are you doing when you're making that logo for somebody? What are you doing when you're making the enclosure for someone's new electronic product? You're solving a problem.
Right.
You're not just making pretty pictures. I mean, you are making art, but you're also creating a solution. So if you can take that and make that a mindset that you're kind of permanently in, I think you're going to find that you're going to get better at a lot of things, and you're going to be more communicative, and it's going to be helpful in a lot of the ways that you create a better business for yourself.
Right. And there was when we first started Maroon Vault, I've started Maroon Vault years and years and years back, but when we grew bigger and we had you guys as new designers on the team,
mm-hmm.
and I wrote essentially a handbook,
right,
about what it meant to be a Maroon Vault designer, and I'm thinking about releasing that same handbook because I just found it, but I have to go through it to see if there's anything internal that I shouldn't divulge in there. But maybe I'll put that down as a downloadable on the website. So if you want to take a look at that handbook, you want to download it, let us know. Send us an email or find us on social media that's something you're interested in, and we'll put it up to be downloaded after I edit it. But what I'm trying to get at is that there's a phrase there that I basically learned during my years of freelancing and learning all these things, because there isn't really a class, at least not that I know of yet, of how to freelance this. Wow, I can't talk today. There isn't a class out there exactly that teaches you how to freelance as a creative person. And what I found out over the years, that it basically encapsulates into this phrase: design must be, above all else, a solution. And I think that explains a lot. I mean, this is a bunch of words that I needed to carefully craft that I thought that would make sense for my designers and my team, and being able to hold together what it meant, at least what I hope Maroon Vault meant for them.
Sure.
As a design firm.
Yeah.
And to me, that was basically, I mean, it took me several days to come up with putting those simple words together, but I feel that it explains it really well. And I'm going to say it again because I think it's a really good phrase to kind of keep in mind. Design must be, above all else, a solution.
Yeah.
So that's probably the best quote that I've ever made up for my team. I don't think I come up with anything better. But I think that if you kind of keep that mindset, and it's true for us, and it may or may not be true for you and what you do in business, but hopefully it's something that can help you keep a mindset that when you're designing something, you should be solving a problem, whether that problem is obvious or not. there's a lot of problems that are just not obvious because we're so used to you know, this minimal problem.
Right. It's already like you glaze over it. It's almost already been solved because you're just not paying attention.
Exactly. Or you basically do a workaround, you know, you change yourself or whatever action physically to be able to create like a temporary solution for that problem, but never really solving it.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that when you go off and set off to design something, do think that whatever problem it has, it's going to have some sort of problem that you can solve. And if you can figure that out, solve that problem through design, you'll be a much more effective designer.
Yeah. And then to reiterate, make sure that you know more than just one application.
That's true. So that brings me to another part of this subject. Now, if you went to design school or a creative school or whatever industry you're in, and this kind of shows itself a lot in our industry, in the industrial design industry, is that we generally develop products, products and vehicles. So we design concept cars and products for consumer electronics. And a lot of times a client will ask us to do other things like engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, manufacturing. And again, all part of problem solving. And I think most creative people out there will say, hey, I'm not an engineer. I don't do those things, which is totally valid. If you're not that, then don't do it. But I think that you should study enough of the subject, even if you're not a mechanical engineer or electrical engineer, know the basics, because you're going to need that. And you may not be able to solve the problem yourself, but I think that at some point, you're going to have to help your client find a solution for that problem. So if it's a mechanical engineering problem, you're not a mechanical engineer, they might ask you to go find a mechanical engineer as a sub-vendor to help you out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's going to happen is that you're going to have to speak and explain to your mechanical engineer what you and your client are trying to do.
Yeah, what you need.
Right.
Yeah.
So knowing the basics of mechanical engineering, and it's nothing like you have to go to, I mean, it'd be nice if you took a couple classes, but it's something that you might be able to learn on the internet or on YouTube to know the general basics of what it is to become a mechanical engineer, how to get parts off of tooling, how to design plastics, you know, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, what is tooling? Not everybody knows, you know, cams and stuff like that. I had to learn that stuff myself. And once you learn more about manufacturing, you have that much more respect for it. I think another thing besides actually looking at yourself as a problem solver, knowing a few programs and being able to understand other aspects of the production, another thing to do to help versatility, honestly, is you sort of just mentioned it now. I just wanted to hunker down on it, is the versatility of having multiple vendors that you know of. You should probably know a business card vendor that you can have a good relationship with. You should know a local CNC place where if you need to get something prototyped in a CNC metal, you can get it done pretty quickly. Those sorts of things will help you in your production processes, right? I mean,
yeah. And as you said earlier today, is that it's another tool that you have in your toolbox. The way that we grew our company is we started off as just design. And then, well, we started off as industrial design. And then we got into graphic design and package design. And then we got into prototyping. And then we got into hiring vendors because we didn't have the machines. And then we got into electrical engineering, and then we got into mechanical engineering. So we developed relationships with all these vendors, and now we're able to offer a lot more than most designers can and most companies can, because essentially what happened is that we started off from like a regular design firm, and we've learned so much over the last two decades that we had become what most clients refer to as a one-stop shop.
Yeah.
Because I may not have the answers. I'm not an electrical engineer. I know enough to understand things about electrical engineering, but I'm not one. I can't make a PCB or anything like that. But I have people in my network who are purely mechanical engineers and who I've worked with before. And so that makes us a much more powerful problem-solving team.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's really helpful to know your local CNC shop, your local injection molding shop, or if you have an electrical engineer that does freelancing as well. I mean, if you're making products, electrical engineering is going to come up. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to happen.
Right.
So,
and so is software engineering.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention that earlier. There's absolutely so many types of engineering.
There's so many types of engineering, and so many of them are used in the technology genre or the technology area. So you just need to make sure that if that's not something you're really well versed in, you should at least know somebody who is.
And that's just part of being a step ahead of everybody else. That's part of the game.
Yeah. Networking, man.
Yeah. I know networking sounds like a scary term, especially for those who are not social. And you know, sometimes the stereotypes are okay about designers. I mean, you know, a lot of creative people don't like to be all that social sometimes. But it's part of the business. And to be completely honest, just look at it as another skill set that you can offer, which you wouldn't otherwise have.
Yep.
And we'll get into another episode about how to do all the billing and you know, all the payroll stuff for vendors like that. But for the most part, yeah, expand your network. And it doesn't have to be like, hey, do you want to be part of my network? It doesn't have to be like that.
I would hope that's not how you approach the situation. But hey, yeah.
I hear that's how you approach women for dates.
Yeah.
Would you like to go on a date with me?
It's more kind of like working on a project together, getting to know that person. And once you've worked with that person, he or she, you might become friends over the years. And we have.
I mean, I've just found we've like gotten a project or something and I'm like, oh, man, we've never done this sort of thing before. I don't have a vendor in my pocket for this. So what do? I go look around for a vendor in the, you know, California area. I ask for a quote and then I am friendly to them.
Yeah. Look at that. Imagine that.
And then since I am friendly to them, they are friendly to me. All of a sudden I know their name. They know mine. And then now all of a sudden I know someone whose sole responsibility it is to be a customer service representative and a quote creator at a new vendor that is now in the local area. And then bam, I can call that. Since I was nice to that person, they are more likely to be willing to help me out in the future.
Right.
And it's really not that hard.
And here's another thing to think about it. Another way to think about it is that regarding people and dealing with people, they will be much happier wanting to help you than having to help you.
Yes. And that's
like
good.
You like that? Should I write that down?
I like that. That's good.
I was keeping that one in my back. Wow, I can't talk, dude. I used up all my English in that sentence.
Oh no.
let me start that over. It's basically, yeah. People love it a lot more when they want to help you versus when they have to help you. And to your point on that, about being nice to that person who does a specific thing, you do that enough times to enough people in that company,
yeah,
you will get the CEO or another executive's attention. And that's where you really want to be. And that's not, I mean, I guess I can say that's a goal, but it's nothing like, oh, I've got to talk to the CEO.
Yeah, it's not a requirement.
It's not a requirement, but it's a good thing to have.
Yeah.
And it's a good thing to kind of like, hey, this is Ben. He's been a really great client. Oh, this is my CEO, so-and-so.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you chat it up, shake hands. And before you know it, you guys are doing projects together where he might need your design expertise and you might need their prototyping expertise and you guys can work together. And now you're working directly with the CEO.
Yeah. You know, it's great to get on a friendly relationship with like the quoting guys and the estimate guys and the sort of production guys. But yeah, like you said, if you are friendly enough and you become sort of friends with the gang at company X that does CNC in your local area, and then all of a sudden you know the CEO, he's going to know other things that are coming in that the employees don't know.
And he also knows other CEOs.
Exactly. And so all of a sudden, just because you've now made, you know, acquaintanceship with this one person, they now know you.
Right.
And that's the most important thing. And
yeah,
they're the ones that are getting the new jobs. They're the ones that know other people that are looking for jobs, and then bam.
And to kind of go a little further from that subject specifically is that at least a part of this story that I'm going to tell in a few seconds here is how I kind of found out that this is the way to build your network. And the way to build your network is exactly, it's as simple as what Ben just said. Don't be an asshole, essentially. Be nice, be kind. If they're mean, mad, or angry or something, it's probably just best to assume that they're probably not angry or mad at you. They're probably just mad at a certain situation that you don't know about.
Right.
And I've learned that. I've had a lot of jobs, Ben. That's another episode, Maroon Cast After Dark. No, I used to be an emergency operator, and when I was in college, I used to be an emergency operator, and the thing that they taught us is that sometimes it's not an emergency. Sometimes it's just towing somebody's car off the freeway for safety. And what they taught us is that they might be yelling at you, they might be mean to you, they might be rude to you, but understand that they're probably just mad at the situation, and you just happen to be close by.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they don't mean it, because that's true, because some people have called back and apologized to me, and you know, same thing. Like I'm sorry. A lot was going on. I didn't mean to sound rude, or I didn't mean to yell at you, and I just want to say I apologize. So that has happened. So if there is an estimate guy or a sales guy, and you try to create a network with this person, and they're rude to you, just brush it off and be like, you know what, okay.
They were probably having a bad day.
Right. And it's safe to assume that way, because it makes you look like a better person anyway, even if they're just bad people to begin with. So that's how you build your network, is that you basically be nice to one person and another. Before you know it, you're friends with a lot of the executives who actually call the shots and write the checks. They move on to other companies and they use your expertise.
Yeah.
So that's a long-winded way of explaining that. So we're going to leave it there for this show. But like I've said, do visit our website, www.maroonvaultstudio.com. If you have any questions that you'd like for us to tackle on the air, is it on the air? Do people still say that?
I don't know.
I mean,
maybe.
On the podcast. And let us know what your questions are or what you're concerned with, and we'll try our very best to help you out with it based on our own experiences. Again, follow us on social media. I'm very active on Instagram. My handle is @IamHectorReal. That's @I, A, M, Hector Real. And if you have any questions, feel free to DM me there. If I can answer it in a couple of sentences, I will. If not, we will put it on a podcast episode. So, this is me signing off, and this is
Ben.
Ben what?
Wetzel. Pretzel.
There you go.
Pretzel Wetzel.
Yes, we're signing off. We'll see you again in the next podcast episode.
Have a good day.